Welcome to episode 2 of Listen in Michigan. I'm Deborah Holdship, the editor of Michigan Today, and in this episode, we're going to revisit the conversation that we began with Jim Tobin in episode 1. Jim's a historian and storyteller, and if you listen to episode 1, you know that he has a host of interesting, weird, wacky, and obscure tales about the less-than-told history of the University of Michigan. He had a few more that we couldn't fit last time, so we're going to finish that conversation today. In addition, we have a short conversation with Aaron Dworkin, an alumnus and the founder of the Sphinx Organization. Aaron returned to the University of Michigan this fall as the dean of the School of Music, Theater, and Dance. And as an alumnus of the school, he has some very thoughtful and provocative things to say about the arts and the future of arts education at Michigan. For now, let's go back to Jim Tobin, who has a story surrounding the controversy regarding the founding date of the University of Michigan. And I'm guessing you probably didn't even know there was a controversy surrounding the founding date of the University of Michigan, which is exactly why it's super fun to know somebody like Jim Tobin who does know these things and who can share them in a very captivating way.
Well, this is a strange story, and it appealed to me partly because I'm the son and brother of lawyers, and this is a very lawyerly conflict. An old guy who had practiced law in Chicago for many years by the 1920s named Frank Culver, a Michigan native and a Michigan alum who fiercely loved the history of the university. When he went to school in the 1800s and then well into the 20th century, people around the university and people in Ann Arbor assumed that the university had been founded in 1837. First classes weren't actually taught until 1841, but 1837 was seen as the time when it was decided that there would be a university in Ann Arbor. Frank Culver took a different view of this. He knew that there had been something called the University of Michigania, also known as the Cathalepistemia. I think I'm the only person in Western civilization who knows how to pronounce that word.
I must give you props for that, by the way.
I practiced it.
It's the scariest word ever.
So this institution had been created in the city of Detroit when Michigan was still a territory. In 1817, it was created by the territorial government with a governing board, one of whom was Gabriel Richard, a famous priest in Detroit history. Augustus Woodward was the guy who came up with the crazy title of Cathalepistemian. But they founded a legal organization that Frank Culver believed had been perpetuated in the form of the university that was created in Ann Arbor 20 years later. Culver wouldn't even agree with 1837 as the formulating date in Ann Arbor, but that's another story. So he made a ruckus about this in the 19-teens and 20s, and it came to a head when he persuaded others in the Alumni Association that he was right and that 1837 was wrong. But there were powerful people, including the regents and Wilfred Shaw, who was the head of the Alumni Association, who thought that this idea of Detroit in 1817 was crazy. Yes, there had been this silly Cathalepistemia that had been formed then, but there hadn't really been a university in Detroit, which is perfectly true. But it got fought out, and it turned out that the Supreme Court of Michigan had recognized the existence of a corporate entity called the University of Michigan, founded in 1817, and that, yes, indeed, it was the organization that should be recognized as the founding. And so the stubbornness of this cranky old lawyer in Chicago, Frank Culver, really won the day. Now, some private schools like Harvard and Princeton go way back farther than that. But the university has a very good claim to being one of the most important early institutions of higher education in the country. Michigan is part of that whole tradition of the great public universities that really have played enormous roles throughout the country's history, and the country just wouldn't be the same without these institutions.
This story about the founding of the university is one example of a style you tend to follow. I've noticed you like to take a historical moment or a specific event and boil it down to a single individual's experience. So talk to me a little bit about your process in writing a story and infusing it with interest for the reader.
I've tried to tell nonfiction stories that are as interesting as a good piece of fiction. And the best stories are about individuals, and usually individuals who are in some way trying to overcome a difficulty. And that reminds me of a heritage story that I'm fond of, which is about the experience of students who went to U of M during the Depression. That includes Arthur Miller. It also includes a lesser known writer, but a favorite of mine named Edmund Love, who wrote a series of autobiographical books, including a terrific book, which is called Hanging On, which is a memoir of his life, trying over many years to get to the point of graduating from U of M. He struggled because his family was in deep financial difficulty. Love set out to try and get money to finish his senior year by winning a Hopwood Award. And so he took a novel writing class, and the professor was sympathetic to Love's industry, to just how hard he worked to try and write this first novel. And so Arthur Miller was in his class, as were a number of other pretty accomplished student writers. So the time for the Hopwood Awards came, and they're in the Union Ballroom, and the awards are announced, and of course he doesn't win. Sort of starts to wander off, and the professor spots him, takes him aside, said, "Mr. Love, I want to speak to you for a moment." He said, "You know, the judge of the novel writing competition this year was none other than Sinclair Lewis, celebrated author of Main Street and Babbitt and so on. Now, Mr. Love, I have some bad news, which is that Mr. Lewis said that your novel was perhaps the worst student novel he had ever read. So, you know, thanks a lot, Chief. Thanks, Professor, for telling me this." But he says that's not the end of the story. "Because I want to tell you, Mr. Love, that I had two students in that class who are going to become professional writers. One of them was Arthur Miller. I don't have to tell you why I hold that opinion of him. But the other one is you, because I've never known anyone, any student in any of my classes, who labored so hard to develop his own abilities. And you've developed your abilities to a considerable extent. And I believe you have the tenacity, the perseverance, and the native talent that will ultimately lead to a career as a professional writer for you." And he was right. Edmund Love did become a professional writer, and a successful one. Not on the scale of Arthur Miller, but he was a successful working writer, and he wrote some wonderful books, including that book, Hanging On, which I recommend highly to people who are interested in the history of the university in that era.
Miller graduated in 1938, and we often hold him up as one of our most beloved and talented alumni. But prior to him coming to U of M, the poet Robert Frost also came to the university in the 20s, not as a student, but as a professor in residence, a poet in residence.
Poet in residence, right. But he did teach in the 20s. A number of students were lucky enough to have Robert Frost sit and critique their poetry and talk to them. Went to teas at the professor's house and chatted with students long into the night. There are students who have extraordinary memories of Robert Frost in Ann Arbor.
It just doesn't even seem real. That's what I love about it. It's just like these great stories, but they're actually true, and they happened here.
That's right.
It's just incredible.
What is it about a story being true that makes it even better? I don't know, but that's the key to writing great narrative nonfiction is to tell a story, but it's also, it actually happened, you know? So that's a great boost.
Yeah, and it happened here. Like, you can sit in the same place, or in fact, Frost's desk is in the library, and I opened the drawer one time just because I wanted to touch the same handle that Robert Frost may have touched once.
Exactly. And you know, when you start to know more about the history of the place, you have those moments all the time. You know, not necessarily a connection with the great and the distinguished like Robert Frost, but just people who were trying to do the same thing that you were trying to, that you're trying to do now as a student or as a professor or as an instructor. That you've all been engaged in this 200-year-long endeavor to learn and to study and to pass knowledge along.
You know, it's interesting to note, too, that there are at least two Frost poems that are attributed to his time here. One is called Spring Pools, which he wrote while he was living on Pontiac Trail in Ann Arbor, and one called Acquainted with the Night, which is just such an evocative title. I love it.
So now I'm going to switch gears a little and revisit the Law Quad. The last time we talked about William Cook, the philanthropist and benefactor for the law school, but we talked mostly about him. I wanted to kind of look at the architecture of the building this time, in particular the stonework. There are these little corbels, the little figurines, stone figurines that were created by an artist named Ulysses Ritchie out of New York City. And they represent a number of different aspects of life. But in particular, there are six that represent the six presidents, the first six presidents of the university. So if you're walking through the central archway into the Law Quad and look up, you may find President Freeze looking back at you, President Angel, President Hutchins or Haven or Tappan or Burton. Some of them are wearing eyeglasses, which I find very funny and charming. Talk a little bit about those little guys. I don't know if a lot of people know that the presidents are there keeping an eye on us all.
I just love those little figures. And this is another good example of how sort of studying the history leads you to new insights. And then doing this research, of course, I learned about them. There's a Cook story there, too. One of the originals was showed the figure of the secretary of the university in that day and age, a man named Shirley Smith, who was an important guy and did a lot of writing about the university. Somehow or other, his image was carved into one of those corbels. And Cook found out about it and was outraged, and he ordered the architects to just smash the stone to get rid of that altogether and put a new figure in its place. So poor Mr. Smith never made it into immortality in the law school.
That is a tragedy. I love the other ones, too, that represent like the seasons. There's a guy with a little sheaf of wheat under his arm. There's a little football player guy. There's a little guy with a tennis racket.
Right. And, you know, there are little details like that all over the campus. Gosh, you walk into what I believe now is the oldest classroom building remaining on campus, which is Tappan Hall, which is where the Department of the History of Art is headquartered. That's a lovely old building where if you walk up and down the staircases and through the corridors, you are in an environment that housed students of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And that's to experience the campus on a whole new level. You know, we love the gorgeous new buildings that have been constructed, but that attention to detail that was characteristic of the earlier buildings, I just think is terribly rewarding. And when you know a little bit about who built those buildings and why they were built that way, you get a sense of this long train of events and people who make up the history of the place. It's just like knowing the history of your own family. You are more likely to carry on the traditions of your family in a good way if you know that history. I think it's the same with the university.
Well, on that note, I'd like to thank Jim for sharing these great little tales. Now we're going to jump into the present and hear from Aaron Dworkin, the current dean of the School of Music, Theater, and Dance.
Over 17 years ago, I was a student at the School of Music, Theater, and Dance. I was a violin performance major. I got both my bachelor's and my master's degrees at Michigan. But it was also at Michigan that I was able to found the Sphinx Organization, which over the past almost two decades has really been able to grow into kind of the leading organization addressing diversity and inclusion in the performing arts. So now to kind of come back and to kind of be welcomed home after almost 20 years to the school is really very, very special for me. And I have a distinct memory as an undergraduate student going into the dean's office, Dean Paul Boylan, and sharing with him that I had this idea for an organization and could I get the school's help and support. And so to now be able to have the opportunity to sit in that office and have my professorship carry his name is really a tremendous honor. This is really, I believe, a unique time in the trajectory of the performing arts in our country and even around the world. But the ways in which we define a performing arts career have changed dramatically over the past several decades. And there are so many incredible opportunities that our students have to build a life in the performing arts. And one of those aspects is how they are relevant to their communities, to society. How is their art form relevant? How does it speak to who we are? And so I hope to be able to engage in those conversations here at the school and to ensure that we are preparing and educating our students to be relevant to their art forms, and as well empower our faculty, the institution, and our students to have these important fields of study be relevant to our communities and to our society. The arts are our soul as a nation. It is how we express ourselves, not only to one another, but to ourselves. And at a time when I think, unfortunately, there are too many divisions and barriers, man-made, that we somehow construct between cultures or classes or different geographical bases that we all have, the arts cuts across all of that and gives us a window into those who are different from ourselves. And I think that not only builds tolerance of difference in others, but also builds our own sense of self. And the arts, that doesn't just happen by magic. There is a craft, there is a discipline, there is a study to these forms of our field. And it's my hope to be able to help ensure that we develop those crafts to the highest level of excellence.
Okay, well, that's it for episode 2. I sure hope you come back for episode 3. If you'd like to subscribe to the podcast in the meantime, please refer to the show notes. You should see a link there that says subscribe to Listen in Michigan. It'd be super cool if you would subscribe. Also, I'd love to hear from you. I'm about to play you a little message that was on my answering machine from one of my favorite alumni, Jack Gartner. He's 91 years old, and he's a 1948 graduate of the university. Jack came to Michigan on the GI Bill post-World War II and had a really interesting student experience. He had to live out at the Willow Run bomber plant off of 94 because the housing was at such a high premium when all the GIs returned from the war. Jack met his wife, Marjorie, there during that time, and he has a very cute story that I asked him to share with you, which he left on my answering machine.
Hi, Debbie. Jack Gartner. I have a short story for your program, if you don't care to record it. It has to do with the end of World War II, and Michigan got swamped overnight with a matter of doubling its enrollment from 12,000 to about 24,000 students. And since there was no room at the inn, so to speak, in Ann Arbor, why, the university bought a B-24 bomber plant from the War Assets Administration, and it picked up all the, in the west end of where the Willow Run, it picked up the single dorms for single men and women, and it picked up all the married housing for the married couples at that time. I was housed in dorm 1. The females were housed in dorm 2, and now the rest of the GIs were housed in dorms 3 through 15. Margie was a nurse during the war, and she got into dorm 2. Of course, I didn't know her at the time. Location of the dorms was such that they were parallel to each other. Margie had to work at the West Lodge cafeteria, which served all the GIs. The single GIs particularly. Margie and the girls, in order to either reach the bus, which was right outside of West Lodge, or go to work inside of West Lodge cafeteria, they had to run the gauntlet between dorm 1 and dorm 2. And the guys in dorm 1 would see them. They'd open their windows and they'd whistle at them and pound the sides of the building just to be obnoxious, I guess. And I spotted Marjorie on one of these runs. My gosh, she had a beautiful face and a beautiful figure. And I said, I just really gotta have a date with that gal. And I didn't know how to do it. But right across the hallway from me in dorm 1 was a real handsome looking guy, older fellow. He was a major in the Royal Indian Air Force. And he knew a number of the gals, and I said, well, when you go down the chow line in the cafeteria, when you see the lady serving gravy and potatoes, he said, I'd like to get a date with her. I didn't know her name at the time. I just wanted a date with that gal. And I said, be sure she's serving potatoes. And sure enough, he got the right gal. I guess he introduced himself to her, introduced me as a fellow that just wants to have a date with you. And she evidently said, yes, I'll put him in the roster. We were married for 45 years. We had 4 children, and I stayed in touch with my friends from Willow Run. Norm Lapeters retired to Central Mexico, and I hear from him literally every single day. He's 91 years old, or 92 years old. So the Michigan relationship has really been significant in my life. I guess that concludes that story. If I get another opportunity to talk about any other short stories, I'll let you know.
All right, well, that's it for now. I look forward to having you back next month. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, go blue.